Welcome to season 4 of And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy And the Writer Is, please rate and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. Listen, I don't know what kind of speakers you guys have at home, but recently my friends at Sonos sent me a speaker and I took it out of the box, downloaded the app, and the thing's incredible. Full frequency range, you know, vocals are clear, bass was bumping. The whole thing was exactly how you want music to be heard. And if you're a songwriter, you know what I'm talking about. You spend all this time making sure that your music sounds perfect in front of a studio monitor. And then you go home, you want to have your Sonos speaker there to reflect the music that you are recording in the studio. So go to www.sonos.com and get yourself a speaker. If you want to get more, it's so intuitive. You get more and the app will figure out how to make your system even functional within itself. So again, you can listen to Spotify, Apple, whatever it is, but go to www.sonos.com and get yourself a speaker now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's multi-award-winning, multi-platinum songwriter, artist, musician, has had a decade-long run of success, including 7 number one top 40 country hits with legends like Kenny Chesney, The Band Perry, Sam Hunt, and Dierks Bentley, all while scoring Old Dominion. Winning this year's ACM Award for Vocal Group of the Year, this guy has cemented himself as one of the premier frontmen in Nashville. This Virginian is not only a staple in the music scene, but also a family man at home. And the writer is the biggest gear junkie I've ever met, Matthew Ramsey.
Wow. I kind of thought you were going to do that when I was outside the room, but I'm just come busting it.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to make it as uncomfortable as possible to start. So you were signed in 2005. What took you so long?
Yeah, I sucked.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you always suck? No, okay, let's start from the beginning, really. You're from Virginia. Where in Virginia?
It's from a very small town. It's called Buchanan, Virginia. It's spelled Buchanan, but everyone calls it Buchanan.
So okay.
It's about a
thousand.
Is
that an accent problem?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. There's only 1,000 people.
Whoa.
So there's no stoplight.
Like, how many people were at your high school?
Right under 400, I think, right at the whole. I graduated with 70 people.
Crazy. So you still keep in touch with all of them?
No, but some of them.
Yeah.
Some of them I do. Yeah. But yeah, it was a very rural and small town.
When did you start playing? You played drums first. That's your first
I played instrument? Drums. Yeah. I started playing drums when I was, I don't know, sixth grade or whatever. And then as I was in like the drum line and stuff.
Oh, cool.
In like high school and stuff. And but then, you know, everybody in the drum line, all my buddies in the drum line were like, we should have a band, but we all play drums. And then somebody was like, well, I think I got a guitar. And I was like, well, I can probably borrow a bass or something, you know, so that I borrowed a bass. And so the drum line became my first band, and we all started just writing songs together.
What was the band called?
The first incarnation was called Phonology.
Oh,
because we were.
That feels like the era appropriate.
Right, right.
If you know the era, then that's like, yeah, that's pretty spot on.
And then we went into Pork Rinds. Was the name of the band.
But you went, I mean, that doesn't sound particularly like country, which we'll get into later, but I guess Pork Rinds maybe, but I don't know, what kind of music was it?
It was, we just wanted to be Pearl Jam.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. You know, it was like just straight up grunge. It was like Nirvana, Pearl Jam stuff. Yeah.
Shout out to my friends who I'm sure are listening to this from junior high. Yeah. They started a band called Joni's Loaf because it was like Pearl was the grandmother, I think, Grandma Pearl, and it was her jam. They all liked that, and my friend's mom's Joni, and she would make this zucchini bread, and they called it Joni's Loaf. And it was like, I wanted to be in that band. They wouldn't let me in the band. So, like, you know, I take back the shout out. So, deal with it, guys. Tough. Anyway, so did your parents play music?
No. Nobody in my family really played. My uncle did.
What did he play?
And, he played guitar. He's a great guitar player. And he's sort of, he would, like, when I was in that band in high school, any kind of stuff he wasn't using or was done with, he would just at Thanksgiving throw it in the trunk of his car and drive it down, and then I would have like a new amp or some guitar or something.
Is this something he was doing as a profession?
Really just kind of, you know, playing in bars and stuff. He always had like cover band and a day job and cover band. So, but seeing him play, I was like, wow, that, you know, my parents would sneak me into bars just to watch my uncle play, and awesome.
Pork Rinds existed a school of 400 people, so you guys are all in a drum line of that means everybody's doing multiple things. All of you guys must also be on the football team, and then like in the halftime you're like, I'm gonna go pick up this drum and like start drumming. It's like, it's such a small school. Playing shows for?
No one. We played you know, in our basements, and we played a couple of high school functions, and then we played, we did kind of, then there was a city called Roanoke, Virginia, which is about 30, 40 miles away, and we did start getting into some clubs there and start playing, you know, with big black X's on our hands, and, you know, I don't know why my parents ever let us do that, but we were in these bars with grown men, you know.
When you were 17.
When I was 16, 17 years
old. Yeah. Why did you go to college? Like, why did you go? You went to VCU, right?
I did.
Why did you even continue? At that point, you're probably like, I'm playing shows. And
I really loved art too. I was a, you know, a visual artist as well. And that's kind of what I spent my whole entire high school doing, was playing music and creating art. And, so I figured I needed to go to college, but I didn't know what for, and I didn't want to go for music because I had had some lessons before, and the lessons for me felt like I was being made to do it, and I didn't want to do that. I just wanted to make the music that I was enjoying for myself, and I didn't want someone to make. I didn't want it to feel like homework.
Right.
So I went to art school.
Where drawing can feel like homework.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, because my biggest stress was finishing a painting.
Are there similarities between, you know, making art and making music for you?
Yes.
Do you think of them as the same?
I don't think of them as the same, but and they do, you know, sort of tickle different parts of my brain. But the art school, I have said before, was so beneficial to me in this career, is in that, you know, you would go to class, and when your project was due, you know, you're in a class with all these amazing artists, and, you know, on due day, everyone puts their painting up on the wall side by side, and you go down the list, and the whole class critiques you and rips you to pieces. If you're me, you know, I was by no means the best painter in that class or any of those classes, and so they would just kind of rip you to pieces, and you learned, you know, how to take criticism and take, you know, use it, or, you know, it was just gives you a thick skin, really.
It does that, but I guess the similarity is that I did theater classes sure. growing up. And yeah, the idea of also you have to learn how to give constructive criticism.
Yeah.
I think in a way, taking it is something that is useful for obvious reasons. But learning how to give criticism without being a prick.
Yeah, totally. Without just being like, that sucks.
Yeah, and you know.
Yeah, to be able to say, well, you're not executing this quite like you think you are, or.
Yeah. And to try to figure out a way to make it better, you know?
Yeah.
So are you playing music through? Did you graduate?
I did. Yeah. I graduated with a degree in illustration.
And did you play any music in college or that?
I played music all through college. I was playing, whatever little coffee shop I could. I was writing songs.
On your own.
Yeah. And then towards the end of college, I, found some other dudes and we had a band for a little while and we were playing around Virginia.
What was that band called?
That was just my name. That was Matt Ramsey Band.
Yeah.
And then, that was back in the days when that was a cool thing to do.
It's so funny because that's just what it is. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're all in, you end up in bands and you just, if it's Matchbox 20, then you're going to be, Globe 45 or whatever. You know?
Yeah,
it'll be like just throwing a number. If you're the Dave Matthews Band, then you're going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, And when I was in college, that's when I was working at a, literally sorting trash. I was at a recycling place and was sorting trash and there was country music playing. It was always country music in my house growing up. My parents listened to it. It was always on. But I was never like a big like fan. I mean, I knew it all, but that was not what I chose to listen to. But that was on one day in that recycling plant. And I was like, man, I feel like I could write this stuff because I know all of this stuff.
You know? What kind of country was it that were your parents listening to, Merle Haggard and Buck Owens?
Yeah, it was country radio, really.
There was a radio on in the kitchen. Yeah.
And there still is to this day.
Yeah.
There's just a radio in the corner of my parents' kitchen that's at a very low volume, but it's always country radio. So that was always on. And I had some exposure to like the Merle Haggards and Waylon Jennings and stuff through my grandparents and stuff like that.
But it was more like Garth and that kind of stuff at the time. Yeah, sure. Were any of the songs good that you were playing in the Matthew Ramsey Band or even before that?
Good. Yeah, I would say there's probably some merit to them. I mean, there was some bad ones too, but there were a few, outliers that contains some sort of spark,
sure.
Something that was like grabbing some attention in some way.
Did you ever pull from those once you kind of became a professional?
No, not really.
Yeah. What connects you from working in a recycling company to Nashville? Like, what's the story? How do you get from there? To like, I hear this, I could write this to I'm on Music Row.
Well, it's kind of long too because that
took quite a while. Time.
But yeah,
what year? Give me
that
like
was
a
2000-ish.
Okay,
probably 2000. So, hearing that, thinking I could write it was ultimately, wrong that I could go home and sit down and write that.
What does that mean? Why is it wrong?
Because, your ideas of what a country song are and the thinking it's so simple, and it is simple, but it's hard to write that simple. It's hard to do that. So it did sort of shift the way I looked at writing music and, just a more lyrical story than before. But so I graduated college, and when I graduated, I had to make a choice that I was either going to pursue art or I was going to pursue music because I felt like I couldn't half-ass both of them. If I tried to do both, I felt like they were both going to suffer. So I chose music, much to my parents' chagrin, I think.
Were they really angry
they were
about
not,
it?
They were not angry about it at all.
Yeah.
They have been completely supportive of my music all the way through. But so I moved to Blacksburg, Virginia, and was in that band, Matt Ramsey Band. We were playing as much as we could all over the region, playing in Harrisonburg, Virginia, with this band called Small Town Workers. I would go up there and play a lot by myself, and some with this other band, which turns out those members of that band are now in the band that I'm currently in. So I've known those guys forever. But I was, you know, sort of toiling away, writing songs, and then, you know, that band ended up breaking up, and then I made a little CD on my own, went to a little recording studio and made a little disc and was, you know, playing coffee
CD
shops.
CD baby and stuff?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, sure.
Or ordered 1,000 CDs.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I still have about 800 of them.
Uh-huh.
So at that point, there was this radio program on public radio called Mountain Stage. And it was a lot of like folk music and singer-songwriter-y stuff. And I used to listen to it. And they were having a songwriter festival sort of nearby. And I went to it and met Daryl Scott, who's a country songwriter. He wrote It's a Great Day to Be Alive for Travis Tritt.
Sure.
And he wrote a bunch of the Dixie Chicks stuff.
Sure.
And he was like a feature there, and sat in a room and watched him play and was blown away. So I went to him afterwards and said, you know, I'm thinking about moving to Nashville. What do you think about that? And he said, well, you know, if you're going down there to be a star, then I wouldn't do it. He goes, but if you want to go down there and learn how to write a great song and be surrounded by the greatest songwriters and the greatest musicians and learn from that, then I think by all means you should do it. And so I took that to heart and still to this day try to keep that attitude whenever I'm, you know, in a writing session. But that's my attitude towards Nashville, is I've just, when I made the choice to go down there, it was to learn and not with these expectations of just blowing up. So
yeah, that's amazing advice.
So it was super cool advice. At the same time,
so afterwards he leaves, you're still in Blacksburg, and you're
right.
Like, hey guys.
Well,
no, because the band is
together yet or anything. So it's just me and my wife. And
when did you meet her?
In middle school.
No way.
Yeah,
so she was going through all this with you.
Yeah, she's been through the whole thing.
Yeah.
So then we're like, all right.
One-man band, no more.
Totally, yeah. So then it's like, all right, I'm thinking about moving to Nashville, but still not sure. You know, I still haven't been sold. And then I'm working at a stained glass place. I started kind of painting stained glass windows and designing stained glass windows for this thing, Lynchburg Stained Glass in Lynchburg, Virginia. And there's a country artist that was pretty hot at the time. His name is Phil Vassar. He's also a big songwriter too. He was writing all the 90s country hits and stuff. And he's from Lynchburg, Virginia. And his sister came in, and they told me she was coming in. So I, in shameless self-promotion, handed her a CD and said, you know, pass it on if you want. And she called me about a week later and said, hey, I'm going down to Nashville. I want a few more of those CDs. So I gave it to her. And a couple weeks later, she calls me and is like, you should come down here. And so I did. I went down there, and it was at this point, it was August of 2002. And I went to Nashville, and her other sister who worked with Phil Vassar at the time, took me around Nashville, showed me the Bluebird Cafe and all this stuff. And we were like, we drove by all these like big houses, and I was like, man, these houses are insane. And she said, yeah, one of them is Phil's. We're going there after here. So we went to Phil's house, and he was like, man, you know, I heard your music, and you're obviously not an amateur, but if you want to be successful at this, then you need to be here. And so I moved within 2 months. I went down there, and he was amazing. He took me on the road with him and was like, whatever, if you want to come and you want to see what this is like, you need to come out and see what it's like. So I would hop on the bus and go on tour for a couple weeks just to see, and we would sometimes write, sometimes not, usually not. I would just be there just kind of soaking it all in. And his tour manager at the time is now our tour manager, and
No, like, way.
Yeah. I mean, it's
and there's crazy. So many things there. One is, if somebody gives you music, do you listen to it?
You know, no one ever does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, no one ever gives me music. But yeah, the fact that he actually did.
That's what's so surprising. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, for the people in the company to say, that stained glass company, and say, hey, they knew who Phil Vassar's sister was.
Right.
First of all.
Right.
Then they say, you should bring in music and be prepared.
Yeah.
Which you happen to have a CD.
Yeah.
And then you gave it to her, and she had the ear to not only hear it,
right,
but then show her sister, who's working with Phil.
Yeah.
Which meant that they all had a conversation behind your back.
Yeah.
And they were all like, well, why don't we tell this kid to move up here?
Yeah.
And you're sitting there at the stained glass company for that week, being like, she never listened to it.
Yeah.
And you're still going in every day, working away. Yeah. And they're all having conversations about, well, this guy's pretty good. We should bring him up. You know, should we do it? How do we do that? You want to go tell him, like, should you call him? Like, why don't we do that?
Right.
And then you come up and we'll show him Bluebird, and we're going to go and woo him a little bit, and we'll get him. And you're sitting there having no idea any of this is happening.
Yep. Yeah, I know. And you this is actually over the period of a couple of weeks at this point.
Yeah, I'm
still
totally.
There, literally writing songs. I had, you know, you had the old school, like, time punch card.
Yeah.
I had, like, a stack of them, and I was writing lyrics during the day on these time punch
cards. Do you have any of those?
I don't. I wish I did.
Yeah.
I really wish I did. But, yeah, they were just completely...
When you said to your wife, we're going to Nashville.
Yeah.
You didn't have kids yet, right?
No kids yet.
So you're... it's just like, all right, yeah, of course we're going to get up and go. I mean,
yeah.
This is huge, you know? And then you go up, you go on tour, and... For people who haven't seen a backstage tour for Nashville, it's a little different than when you go to a pop concert.
Right.
I think just people in general have, it's a little more of a community.
Yes.
Of people, you know, the roadies are talking to the guys in the band, or talking to you know, everyone. It's not, you know, it doesn't really have this superstar kind of feeling, even with the superstar.
You know, in our band, you know, our goal is to make everyone feel like they're, part of the whole thing, and the you know, we try to create a real family vibe every night before the show. The entire crew comes back, but right before the show, we have a toast, and it's someone's turn every night to do the toast, and you don't know who it's going to be, and it you know it could be the lighting guy, it could be me. You know,
where does that come from? That work ethic, or
Well, we went on tour with Kenny Chesney for about 3 years, and he has that vibe for sure. He treats everyone so well, and we just wanted to kind of carry that through.
Do you get nervous?
Performing?
Sure.
No.
Did you ever?
No. The only time I really got nervous, I get nervous if I have to sing at somebody's wedding.
Oh, yeah.
And I get, or I have done a funeral. But that's the only real time.
Yeah.
I mean,
What kind of person doesn't get nervous in front of a bunch of humans while you're about to go and like yell in an amplified microphone?
Right. You know, I guess maybe at some point I did, but I guess I sort of always had this feeling that what's going to happen, man? You know, I mean.
Right. What's the worst case scenario? Is that I walk off stage?
Yeah, I mess up. Yeah. Oh, okay. You know, right. You know, right. I never really.
Right.
Got nervous.
So this is, you know, you go on tour with Phil.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, at this point, probably 2003 or 4 even, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because that's a long period of time when you're talking about, you go up there. It's a lot of work of meeting people, waiting for tours to start. You're going on tour. You're not performing or writing with them. You're just going for the vibe.
Right.
What brings you... Does he start booking sessions for you? I mean, when do you start writing?
No, co-writing? Really, the best thing that he did for me was just sort of pull the curtain back a little bit. And he never really set anything up for me or even really opened any doors for me except for him, you know. I had to hit the ground running when I moved there and start making a name for myself as best I could. And it took me longer than... It takes some people, I think. It took me a solid 10, 15 years to scratch the surface, I feel like, you know. But, you know, I was just, I was there, and I didn't like tour extensively with him. I would just go out for a week or two, and then I'd be home for a month or whatever. And I was just writing, going out to Writer's Night. Literally, opened the phone book the first night we were there, and like saw Songwriter Cafe, Broken Spoke Songwriter Cafe. Let's go there. Went there, met some friends that I'm still friends with today. You know.
I think a lot of
Luke Laird actually was there. That's how I met Luke Laird.
So
was
sick.
In the little, crappy little green room of this little place that I looked up in the phone book.
Friend of the podcast, Luke Laird. Yeah. Good man. You know, I think a lot of new writers assume that they're trying to get in with the Luke Lairds or the Max Martins or whoever's at the top right now. Yeah. And what they don't realize is it's their peers that they meet at those places that will become that. Absolutely. And those guys will be the Phil Vassers.
Yeah.
And those guys will be, whatever it is, totally. The LA Reader, whoever's, the older than Max version, you know.
Yeah.
But they work. You have to work your way up with your peers, just like any other industry, And it's just something where I think people assume sometimes it happens where they get to work with some great right off the top. But what a good mentor is what Phil did, which was show you what to do, and then you go and hustle and you make it happen.
And I would play, I would send him music every once in a while, and he would listen and go, "You're doing everything right, man. Just keep going."
Great.
And he never was like, "Let me play this for so and so. Let me play this for so." He would just say, "You're doing it right. You're doing it right. Just keep doing. You're doing everything right."
You moved the band up. Or they moved up also.
Well, they so...
They must have seen what you were doing and were like, well, want to play.
It was funny. Like, at one point, when I was on tour with Phil, we played in Charlottesville, Virginia. And I walked off the bus and some of the guys were actually working as, the stagehands for the local, stagehands that day. And they were like, "Dude, Ramsey just stepped off the bus." They're like, "What is he doing?" And I would always call them. They were still together. They were still that band, Small Town Workers, at this point. And I would call them all the time and be like, "Man, you guys are such a great band. You got to come down to Nashville. You would kill it." And they were a rock band. And I was like, the scene is not just country. You got to come down here. You guys would kill. They broke up. So they sort of one by one moved down. It was the drummer that I also grew up and met in middle school with. He came down.
Was he part of the drum line?
He was in the competing drum line.
He was
in the drum line that was way better than ours.
Really?
He was always amazing, and we would always go watch his performance because he had solos and stuff. He was great. So he moved down, and Jeff, the bass player, moved down because he wanted to be like a session guy or a touring musician. And then Brad, I didn't really know that well. He was in a different band, and he sort of moved down a few years later. But at the time, it was a different guitar player that was is now also a successful touring musician, and the singer from that band plays for Taylor Swift now. And I mean, it's like everyone came down and hit it, man.
Yeah.
So
it's nice to know when you're growing up and you look around, you're like, "All these people are really talented." That may mean that they're world-class talented and not small-town talented.
Right, yeah, that's a great way to look at it, yeah, because it is. You just have to put yourself in the right position and work your ass off.
Right, exactly.
But they all came down, and, we were just kind of their buddies. And, I'm writing songs. I'm writing songs with this guy, Trevor Rosen, that I had met in Nashville. And so the songs that Trevor and I were writing – I was, I always wanted to play gigs. I always wanted to go play the songs I wrote. So I would book myself at whatever little club in Nashville and go play. And then I'd need a band, and my buddies were here. So I'd be like, "Hey, can you guys want to come play? I can't pay you, but, and they'd be like, "Yeah, dude, let's go play."
That helps that you have friends
in
those places.
Yeah.
As many of you know, I have an album coming out this summer. I talk about it a lot. It's called The Wrong Man. And one thing I learned very quickly when we finished mastering it and before it's come out is that I want to play it for anyone who comes to our house. But you know, it's weird to have people come and just sit in your studio and listen to your studio monitors. You want to have dinner. You want to have, you know, people sitting around and enjoying the music in the way normal people enjoy music. So my friends at Sonos recently sent me a speaker, and I'm telling you that it's incredible. It's something of a game changer because it's easily portable, so I can put it in different rooms, but we just set it up. I took it out of a box, downloaded the app, and I pressed play, and I was sold because vocal clarity's there, the bass is there, the transparency is brilliant, and you can have a speaker that is affordable and easy to play and set up that genuinely shows the work I've spent in the studio. So if you want to get a speaker, go do it at Sonos.com. I'm telling you, you won't be sorry. It is an incredible experience for musicians to have speakers that represent the sound that they're recording in the studio. So again, go to Sonos.com and grab a speaker now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You guys signed, though, kind of early, right? I mean, the deal with RCA is pretty early.
It's pretty new, but no, we toured for years on our own with no deal or anything. So, I guess 2007 is when we really started playing as this band.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we were touring around the country in a van for the longest time.
Was it hard for them to convince? Were they all married? Is it hard to convince your wife at that point that, hey, I'm going to leave because I'm going to go tour in a van? Or
yeah,
she
it wasn't
always
the
like,
easiest. It wasn't the easiest thing. But, I mean, sort of at this point, so there's a little buzz happening about the songwriting, and that's helping, you know. So I'm starting to get some traction as a songwriter around the time the band starts to take shape.
Yeah.
So finally starting to get a little bit of movement there, and I'm getting, you know, I've got a publishing deal and I'm making a little bit of money, so I'm not really getting any cuts yet, but
you're eating,
right?
You're making music and eating, yeah. And you're not having to work,
right?
At, you know,
yeah. So then it would be like we wouldn't go, you know, we would go out for a couple of nights, you know, it would just, you know, I would take all the car seats out of the minivan, and then then the dudes would jump in and we would drive to Alabama and play, you know, come back. And
where did the name come from?
It's the nickname for the state of Virginia, since all of us are, or most of us are, tied to Virginia,
right?
Looking for something.
And yeah,
really the only thing I could find, we were setting up in a bar one night, and I was like, guys, the only thing I can find that's not taken is Old Dominion. And they went, what's wrong with that?
Yeah,
and that was it. So
makes sense.
Yeah.
When do you sign with Shane McNally, who becomes, you know, your first real main co-writer, as far as, I mean, it's him and Josh Osborne in a way that where you start really getting those, I mean.
Yeah, Shane and Josh.
Huge names to as random co-writers.
You right. Know? Well, that's because I had met them before they were huge writers, and we were all writing together. And, you know, Shane would come over to my house and we would write. And I think at the time, when I met him, he had one song, Last Call by Leanne Womack, was his only song that he really had going at the time. But, it, you know, to us, it was like,
That's
he's
a big
got he's got world. Something, yeah. You know, like and so we were all just writing together, and then Shane just blew up, and Josh blows up, and you know we're all then you know like you were saying your class of peers,
yeah.
We were in that class, so we start to get it too, and we start rising up, and same. It's just naturally happened with Shane and the band. We've been, you know, in demo sessions and stuff with Shane where he produces these demos, and you know, meanwhile the band is happening, and we start talking about, you know, cutting some music on our own, and we were like, man, you're so good in the studio when we make these demos, you should just come produce us. And he was like, well, yeah, I'll do that, you know. And so, you know, at this point, he really didn't have a whole lot going on. He was really starting to break as a songwriter at that point.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I guess Chainsaw is really sort of the first
big one. Yeah, the first one I heard on the radio was a song called Wake Up Loving You. That was Craig Morgan's song. But then Chainsaw was the one that really sort of was like, okay, I think it's gonna work.
Yeah.
So, and
what's it like to go from, you know, your parents have this little radio in their kitchen, which means that they can hear that song at home, which means they heard it a lot.
Right. Yeah.
You know, what's it like for all the people who are around you?
Everyone that's around me is so, they're so supportive, and they make me feel so good because, you know, we skipped over a lot in this story of years of being broke in Nashville and just job after job and, you know, wanting to give up.
Give me a list of some of those jobs.
I mean, I was an egg cook. I worked for an art gallery. I worked for a moving company, you know, whatever I could do, you know, just because we were broke, I would do, you know, I would work at a coffee shop. I was just like anything to help me pay the bills, and which was really super tough to do. So it was, you know, it's a grind, man. It took a really long time. And so for it to like actually work, everyone around me, I think, knew how hard I'd worked at it.
Yeah.
And they're so proud and so supportive. And
you know, when did you feel like that was, I mean, obviously, I would assume it's that song. I mean, as you said, you had heard songs on the radio before, but it's almost harder to see a song go at radio and then not go all the way.
Right.
You know, there has to be a moment where you, I think I just did it.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's like, sometimes I do feel that. Sometimes I think, you know, with the Dierks Bentley's song, Say You Do, was my first number one. And I think, you know, that was, you're just always in Nashville. It's such a number one song driven thing that, at least in the writing community, it's like, that's the brass ring. That's what you want. So I think that was the moment where I was like, ah, I got it, you know, but I still never felt like I had it forever, you know.
Did you want to ever stop being an artist once you see, because it's right around the same time that the artist stuff really starts to break, but is there a point there where you're like, well, I'm making it as a writer. Why am I spending time on the road in a van if I'm making X amount in a session with friends and then I can go home? Like, why do you do that to yourself?
I don't know. But, you know, I didn't ever want to quit doing that. We were having too much fun. You know, it was just, there's something about writing the music and then being able to be the artist that performs it, for me, that is extremely gratifying. You know, it's to be able to, there's a connection for sure that people have with your songs. And sometimes I feel like as a writer, you miss that. And you don't get the joy of seeing that. And when, you know, like right now in the spot that this band is in, you know, I can walk out onto a stage and there's 10,000 people there. And they're all smiling from ear to ear. And it's because of the music that we created from nothing. And that is like, holy shit, man. Like, if I was a songwriter at home, I wouldn't be able to feel that.
It's 10 times the size of your hometown every night. You can't really describe that. If you put everyone in your hometown and then cloned them each 10 times
every night.
It's an impossible thing to imagine what that's like.
Yeah, you know? It's an unreal feeling, man. And it's just...
You kind of break as an artist off of songs that aren't particularly country.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think we're both part of the last generation of people who remember Aisles and Stores, but are making music in an environment that has no genre.
Right.
What makes you country?
I think it's, you know, I think for the longest time, I was writing what I thought was country. You know, I was trying to write for country radio. And there's a certain, I guess back then too, there was a certain like kind of unspoken set of rules for country.
What were those? Like,
it's just very like, you know, the hook has to be like really nicely set up and perfectly delivered and put a nice little bow around it. And there can be no room for interpretation, really. It's just everything has to be so perfectly clear. And I was trying to, and then also then write about, you know, boots and trucks and shit like that, that I don't really, that's not who I am, you know? And nor was it Shane or Josh or, you know, these guys. So when we sort of all collectively made this decision, we talked about it a bunch of just to stop trying to do that and start writing music that we really loved. And that's when we all got attention. So it just sort of, I think spending so much time trying to chase those rules, some of it became ingrained in us and became who we were as writers naturally. And then we were making music that we loved, but there was a little hint of those, like of that country thing that was there. And I think it is about the storytelling aspect of it.
The era of what you guys released and then what Sam Hunt released at the same time,
right,
which I know you worked on, is really becomes kind of like the defining sound for like the next year or two.
Yeah.
Did you recognize that influence that you were having?
I don't think so, no.
Can you recognize it now?
I don't think so either.
Yeah. I mean, like Break Up With Him, Make You Miss Me are like, it's just, they're in the same family.
Right.
You know, and I know that one is you and one Sam.
Right.
But they obviously, you were, you can hear your, can hear the DNA in it.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I don't want to skip too far, but the next album goes from being that into almost like a, I was saying earlier, like it feels like a Coldplay influence, or there's moments of, I don't know, there's almost like Jason Mraz meets Coldplay with like, you know, to me it doesn't, it was again, I'm going to go and push myself to sound different than the last thing I sounded like. Is that by design or am I just reading too much into it?
No, I think some of it is. I think we're always looking to you know, write something that's, you know, next, feels like it's next or feels, you know, it's, you don't want to get bored with the same type of thing. But some of it is also just being on the road for so long with the same group of guys. And, you know, we're obviously developing a sort of a sound that is made up of whatever chemistry the five of us have together. And we write a lot together. So we're playing 200 shows a year. And there's a certain sound that comes out of that. And I think you just sort of develop into this more bandy type of thing than we were before.
Why do you still write for other artists?
You know, I still just love writing, and I'm not good at, I don't, you know, really write for other artists.
You just write songs. And sometimes you're like, ooh, I should do this.
Yeah, and you know, I think we, as a band too, we try to keep that attitude and just write the best song we can no matter what. And then, you know, there have been songs that we thought no way would that be an Old Dominion song. And then we play through it and go, actually, that's pretty awesome. We don't have anything like that. And it does sound like us. And then there's songs that we thought for sure were Old Dominion songs, but then we're like, that's actually not us.
Right. Did you ever have a song that you were like, oh, this is an Old Dominion song, and then we're like, nah, that's not us, and then it became a hit?
Well, we have a song by Michael Ray that's on the charts right now.
Yeah.
Called The One That Got Away that we were going to cut. And we messed around with it a little bit and didn't cut. And now it's at like 13 or something right now.
He's a nice guy. I like Michael Ray.
Yeah, yeah.
Shout out to that guy.
Yeah.
Haven't seen him in a while. Glad to see he's doing well. So I want to go through a couple other records, though. I think Song for Another Time, what you do something with your lyrics, is it, and I'm trying to figure out if it's you or if it's your co-writers or not, but you have this, to me, I think what makes it country and not pop is there's that one extra layer of like you expect it, you know, the make it sweet, which I know is the current single and whatnot, but where the life is short, make it sweet, and you know, some of these like kind of twists of phrase,
right?
Like I feel like they're made to be on a t-shirt
for sure. Kind of thing. It's like a bumper sticker.
Yeah,
totally.
Is that, to me, that feels like what current country?
Yeah, it can
good
be.
Country is like songs that I want to listen to that still have that moment.
Yeah,
and the thing that we miss in pop, I think a lot of times when we're trying to talk about a lot is how do we get how do we capture the essence of a tour title in a pop song? You know that's supposed to be about emotion. And in yours, there's like it's a lot of subtext in the emotion. And then, you know, the way it still feels like it's wrapped up. Like to me, it still feels really clear. So it's interesting you were saying, you know, the old country is almost like everything had to be super clear. And either I interpret it a certain way as a listener because...
Yeah, I think we still do hold on to that some. I think we do. That's the part of it that sort of became... ingrained, and it's just kind of happens now, but like, and some of it is like, you know, that like you brought up Make It Sweet, that is just like, that is a t-shirt, it is a bumper sticker, and that was just something that came out and I wrote down, like, that's too perfect to not write.
You know? I hope you still have more of that for when we write in a half hour. I mean, I mentioned one man band. I said that. I said I told my wife that I thought it reminds me of us because we met when I was playing guitar, acoustic guitar, playing a set.
Yeah,
she came up afterwards, said, "Hey, you got nice tone," and then disappeared. And it was it was like her Cinderella moment.
That's cool.
And I was like, "Who's this person who said you have nice tone?" Like no one says that,
right?
You know, she didn't say like, "Hey, good job," or like, "I like that song," or something like something so specific
about nice tone.
Yeah. And the idea that we went from being just, you know, incredibly broke to not incredibly broke is just shocking, you know?
Yeah.
But I like the idea of going through it together with someone.
Yeah.
That sounds like a song, and I'm sure it probably took you half a day, but it sounds like a song that you worked on for a long time. Is it not? Do you write that quickly?
Yeah, that would happen very fast.
Damn.
Why? It's funny.
Why do you have this?
Yeah, it was... someone was on the bus. It was like a radio person or something, and I can't remember what he was talking about, but he said one man band, and just the way he said it, I went, "Oh, that's a really cool idea." And he walked off the bus, and I tapped Brad, our guitar player, and I said, "Hey, we got to write one man band." And he was like, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Man, I think it's a cool idea." And then we were getting ready to go on stage. The intro was happening. We're supposed to be walking on stage, and I went, "I'll check it out. I don't want to be one man band." We're recording it into the phone. Yeah. We're like, "Oh, that's really cool." And then we like ran out and played the show. And then that idea sat on my phone for probably a month or so. And then,
that's the key though.
Yeah.
You may have written it very quickly, but that month, there are times where you're revisiting that.
But
in your head?
We never revisited it.
No, but internally,
maybe. Maybe.
No?
Maybe. But then...
Damn.
Then we were back out on the road.
Give me a bone. Yeah. Throw me a bone?
Yeah, I don't
Give
think
me a bone. It's not something I want. Throw me a bone.
give you a bone.
Don't do that. Throw me a bone, maybe. That's crazy.
Yeah. But then, you know, and then Josh Osborne came out on the road with us. And, you know, we're backstage at, you know, some show and in the dressing room. And, you know, said, I was like, hey, remember that idea of One Man Band? And
do you find, wrote it. I've written with some, a lot of Nashville sessions right. and gone, but one of those sort of rules in the pop world is, but how many people can relate to being in a band? Right. And my argument is like, well, the more that you tell your story, the more people find themselves in it and sure. they start to relate to it.
Sure, yeah.
Do you find that when you release a song like that, Make It Sweet, everyone can relate to
right.
it?
Right, right.
But One Man Band, which I personally relate to, I can't imagine everybody can relate to.
Right.
Do you find that to be the case now having seen, you know, performing that for an audience? Can you see the difference in that lyric, or do people put themselves in One Man Band?
I think,
even if they're not a musician,
I think you can relate to it as a musician or just as a love story, you know. But I think too, man, I kind of come to that question a lot too. Sometimes it's like, is it too inside? Is it too like, do people really know what it's like to be, if we write about the road or if we write about being in a band or a musician, is it too inside? But some of it is, man, that just social media and everything, like our job is to actually include everyone in every single thing we do now anyway.
Yeah, right.
So they know details about what it's like anyway. So I think they can relate in that way. But then if they can't, then I think they do try to, they probably latch on to the love story side of it.
Why do you still do this?
The easy answer is just because I absolutely love it. I mean, when there's nothing better, really. I mean, when I write a song, I feel so good. And when I play a show, those are the moments where I know I'm living my purpose. And it feels really good. And if that goes away, then I won't do it anymore. But right now, it's really great.
On to this next segment. We'll call this 5 for 5. It's funny. I was talking about this the other day in a session. Someone's like, I hate that you never had a name for that and that you always talk about how you don't have a name for it. And it drives me nuts.
You need like a little like jingle.
Yeah. 5 for 5. 5 for 5. 5 for 5. Man. Oh, weird. See how I just ended
That's up? How easy it is, folks.
Spent all night working on that. All right, let's go with Trevor. This is what the deal is. I'm going to give you a name. You can figure it out. Trevor Rosen.
Trevor Rosen is, I would say he's like a partner in crime for sure. He's the guy that like we latched onto each other. We met on stage at a writer's round. We hit it off and we sort of rose through all the ranks side by side, even down to the like the Ben Perry thing. He got a Ben Perry cut, I got a Ben Perry cut, and they were both up for the first single and he won out on that one. But we just seemed to always be just kind of joined at the hip.
Shane McAnally.
Shane McAnally is like, I could talk until I cried about Shane because he's just such a beautiful soul and person and creative force, and on top of all of those things, he's a great friend and such a supporter of your dreams, and he's just the best.
Josh Osborne
is I just think of a smile when I think of Josh. Josh makes me smile, and also is just such a unique brain. His brain works like no other, and it's quicker than any other brain I know, and it's more sensitive than any brain I know. His brain and his heart are one thing.
Phil Vassar
is, I owe so much. He's the mentor, you know. He's the guy that will always seem larger than life to me, even though you know, Old Dominion has, it's hard for me to see. We talk about it sometimes. Old Dominion has grown to levels that are way bigger than he ever got as an artist. But I can't see that. I still see him as this mentor figure that, you know, I'm so thankful that I came across him.
I like that a lot. Your wife?
My wife has been through hell and back. She's a great person. And, you know, we were kids and we've grown through this whole thing. Sometimes together and sometimes separate. And, but she's a huge supporter and I couldn't have done it without her for sure.
Well, thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Let's steal more of it in a little bit because we're going to write a song together. But, you know, the idea of being someone who is willing to put their name out there and attach it to a song. You know, I asked if you get nervous being on stage. I didn't ask if you get nervous, you know, when you have a song out, you know, coming out.
Right.
But I don't think people recognize how brave someone is to put music out, that they're putting themselves out there for strange ridicule. It's like walking into, you know, right, some mall naked or something and then, right, you know, just living your life. I mean, it is so strange. Every time your song is put in the ether, other people are listening to it and judging it because, right, people are experts at listening to music.
Sure.
You know, and it's one thing when you write a song and someone else puts it out. If it doesn't work, climbs up the chart, it, right, goes away, and you're back for another day, and it's, right, fine. It's a whole other thing when you start building when your brand is somehow attached to your music, and people, they don't judge just your songs.
Right.
People will say like, oh, I don't like Taylor Swift.
Right, yeah.
Which is not fair. That's not really how it actually works as a songwriter, as, right, an artist. Like, you're putting this out because it's fun to put out music and you're willing to be honest, and then, yeah, someone ridicules it. But I listen to your music and I feel connected to it because it speaks to me.
Right.
So as somebody who is on the outside, I appreciate when you write with honesty, and I appreciate that, I mean, the fact that I can find myself in any of the songs,
right,
says a lot from a songwriter's perspective.
Right on, yeah.
Because it'd be really easy for me to just say, these are just good songs.
Right.
But it's not easy for me to be like, hey, Jackie, this is, you know,
yeah,
listen to this. This should be our song.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a different thing. I can't compliment you more than that from one writer to another.
Yeah, I
really appreciate that.
So much. Thank you so much. So,
thanks again for doing this, and excited to write a record with you.
Absolutely. Let's get to work for sure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silverstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.